So this is a pretty, Klaus's talk is a pretty hard act to follow. What we're doing in Canada is a slightly different mountain pine beetle genomics project, and I'd just like to introduce what we call the TREA project. This is a two-year project that started at the beginning of this year, and these authors here are just some of the people that are involved in the project, and I'll explain in detail this project momentarily. So the TREA project, the TREA stands for three, or a Greek for tree, sorry, a Greek for three. And that represents the three organisms that we're studying, the bark beetle, the fungal associates, and the pine hosts. In British Columbia, the major host of mountain pine beetle is lodgepole pine. But we're seeing, as you saw maybe in Alan Carroll's talk, that the mountain pine beetle range is extending into Alberta, where hybrid and jack pine are important host trees. So we're trying to understand the whole system and how the genomes of these three organisms interact and how they are actually interacting with the environment as well. So our project objectives are to develop the genomic resources and to develop new information in these three organisms, the bark beetle, the tree, and the associated fungi. And then we are wanting to develop an integrated genetic landscape map of this complex and then incorporate those into ecological risk models. Now, I'm certainly not an expert in any of these fields, except for maybe some into the bark beetle genomics. So we have a very large collaboration with many institutions and people. So the research organizations involved are from both the University of Alberta, British Columbia, and Northern British Columbia, the Natural Resources Canada, and the Michael Smith Genome Science Center, who's doing all our sequencing and bioinformatics. For funding, we have Genome British Columbia and Genome Alberta. The people involved is quite extensive, and they include expertise not only in bark beetles, trees, and fungus, but also in genomics, population genetics, ecological risk modeling, etc. So we have a very complex and integrated mixture of expertise to accomplish this project. I've highlighted in yellow some of the people that are actually in this room and will be talking, or in the case of Dazeem here, today. I want to specifically talk about our genomic resource development and then develop a little bit further into what we're doing with the bark beetles. So I'm talking here about full-length enriched cDNA libraries and paired-end EST sequencing. This is not genome sequencing, but rather the sequencing of the expressed genes in these organisms. Colette, our next speaker, will be talking about the actual genome sequencing of Ophiostomala clavigerum. And for those of you familiar with the fungal phylogenies, there's been a recent renaming of this, so it's also called Guasminia clavigera. So that's sort of synonymous here. What I mean by paired end ESTs, you heard from Klaus that his EST project was from a 5' direction. We're actually doing sequencing from both 5' and 3' ends of the genes. And this gives us an idea of actually how more information about the genes. So I'd like to show you what we're doing in pine cDNA libraries. We're just getting going on this. Our goal is to sequence 20,000 clones from the two species, that's lodgepole pine and jack pine. And it's important for us as we go further into this project to have biological materials, especially in the pine, where we know the genetic background. So we've got lodgepole pine from the breeding program here in British Columbia, and we're currently making the cDNA libraries. And for the jack pine, we've actually just received the jack pine seedlings, and we're getting them ready for development and treatment. Fungal cDNA libraries, our goal is 25,000 clones sequenced. And here are the six libraries that we've already prepared and sequenced. And to give you an idea, there are multiple strains of this fungus, and we're actually making libraries from both this specific strain, the KW4107, as well as multi-strains. And what we did, we're trying to express as many genes as possible so we can sequence them. So what we're doing is putting these fungus in various different conditions. And Scott DiGostini and Colette here has done these. And using, for instance, lodgepole pine, sawdust, starch, organic nitrogen, inorganic nitrogen, or olive oil, are all these different treatments that the fungus are growing on and then potentially would induce different genes. I want to point out here, we are making both non-normalized and normalized libraries. And that's sort of a technical question, and what that means is if some cell type is really highly expressed, we have a lot of sequences of the exact same gene, much what Klaus mentioned with the B1 and D12. We see a huge number of the same transcripts in our libraries, and that's a little bit, it's informative, but it also kind of wastes our money in terms of the sequencing dollar. So through the process of normalization, we reduce the abundance in our cDNA libraries of the very highly abundant transcripts, and then therefore we can start to sequence those that are very low abundant. So for some of our libraries, you can see that we have both normalized and non-normalized, and you can see that the uniqueness in our libraries is much better for the normalized libraries. So this uniqueness is actually a percentage of when we sequence the first 1,000 clones, we assemble them and to see how many unique genes there are there. And so this, what this means is after sequencing 1,000, 900 of them are completely unique amongst each other. And this is our sort of progress report on how far we've sequenced, and we're about 86% into our goal. Based on about 37% of our goal, we did this Cat3 assembly, much like Klaus described. And because we're sequencing from both the 5' and 3' directions, we can assemble them in two different ways, combined or 3' reads only. 3' reads only is a conservative, is a better conservative estimate of actually how many tentatively unique genes there are. You can imagine if there's a very long transcript and you're sequencing from both ends and these two reads do not overlap, that's actually counting as two singlets. But if they overlap, then that's one contig. Whereas if we're only looking at 3' reads, they should all be independent, if they are independent. And so what we can see, even after only about 37% of our goal, we have nearly about two-thirds of the predicted genes in the genome. So we're actually well on our way to fully, I wouldn't say fully sequencing, but fully getting a very good amount of transcripts from this fungus. And what this is useful for is actually helping to annotate the genome that Colette is about to talk about, as well as we now have these clones in the freezer that we can use for functional characterization. Next, I want to talk about the bark beetle cDNA libraries. And both Ruby and Klaus showed us the life cycle of these insects. And what we're interested in particular in BC, is understanding both host colonization and cold tolerance. So one of the major factors that we might see the host shift is through climate change and getting the range into higher in British Columbia and into Alberta. So the way the beetles, in particular the larva and pupa, survive the winter is important to us, as well as the colonization of new host trees, and that involves pheromone biosynthesis, olfaction, and detoxification of host volatiles and host defense compounds as they enter the tree. In our case for the beetles, we're trying to sequence 100,000 clones. These are the libraries that we have so far made, and you can see that they represent most of the life stages and tissue types that we're interested in, starting from the larva and pupa, 10 or adults, and then we have quite a number of adult tissues, specifically the antennas, JH-treated adults, just adults, adults that have been fumigated with a variety of monoterpenes to hopefully induce detoxification genes. As well, like we have seen with Klaus, JH-treated adults from which the midguts and fat bodies have been dissected, as well as the midguts and fat bodies of fed adults. We're also currently working on a head-specific library and cold-adapting larvae. So we're Dazeen's student is actually out in the field collecting larvae right at this time as these larvae are going into winter. And hopefully the genes that are responsible for making them survive the winter are upregulated. And once again, you can see there's both normalized and non-normalized library for some of these tissues, and we do see significant differences in the gene discovery rate for those. And these are our current state of how many clones that we've sequenced in these libraries, and we're at about 63% of our goal. Based on about 46% of our goal, we can see a similar kind of Cap3 assembly as I showed you for the fungus, and we have about 9,000 tentatively unique genes, and that represents about 60% of the genes that are found into the Tribolium genome. So we're actually really good in terms of finding many of the bark beetle orthologs of many of the transcripts in the Tribolium genome. And by comparison, we find actually about 17% of those genes are not actually found in the Tribolium genome. So there could be some interesting genes in there in that that may be bark beetle specific. So now that we have all these genes, we have to start understanding what they're all doing, or some of them are doing. And we'll take you back to the life cycle again, and just to reemphasize that we're interested in the cold tolerance genes and those that are involved in post-colonization, which includes detoxification, pheromone biosynthesis, and olfaction. And Dazeen and I have sort of broken up those four aspects, and Dazeen will be looking at cold tolerance and detoxification, while I'll be looking at olfaction and pheromone biosynthesis. And I'm going to concentrate mostly on detoxification and olfaction and pheromone biosynthesis, but I just want to emphasize that Dazeen's group is finding many of the genes involved in predicted importance for cold tolerance, for instance, the biosynthesis of glycerol and other cryoprotectants. One thing that's in common with at least these three aspects are cytochrome P450s. And Klaus and Ruby mentioned cytochrome P450s, but I just want to emphasize that again, is that they're specifically for our interest that they're important for the detoxification of plant secondary metabolites, involved in pheromone biosynthesis, pheromone or hormone degradation, as well as odorant degradation. In Tribolium, which is the only coleopteran from which the genome has been sequenced, there's about 134 P450s. And actually, we heard on Sunday that in Zhu and Pauli's talk, they predict actually more like 141 P450s. So far, in our build 3, we have about 650 ESTs that show annotations to cytochrome P450s, and it represents about 100 different cytochrome P450s. What we find is that, as you can see here, that most of them are actually CYP6s. We have also identified the NADPH cytochrome P450 reductase, which is the redox partner for most cytochrome P450s. And we've actually functionally characterized this and have got activity from recombinant cytochrome P450 reductase. Klaus and Ruby have provided a really good description of the pheromone biosynthesis. And I just want to reiterate here that for many bark beetles, pheromone biosynthesis is de novo, and it seems like for most of the, or a lot of the bark beetles, it's through the mevalonate pathway, at least for some of the terpenoid compounds. And in the case of Ips pinei, we see that JH treatment induces the mevalonate pathway and pheromone biosynthesis. And as Klaus mentioned, there's been work in the Jeffrey pine beetle, which is Dendrocrinus jeffreyi, so it's a similar situation for the formation of frontalin. Mountain pine beetle pheromone biosynthesis is a little bit more complex than in Ips. There's multiple components. There's both female and male produced compounds. And as you saw in Klaus's talk, the timing of these pheromone biosynthesis is very, very specific. So we're starting to find genes that may be involved in some of these pathways. For instance, a potential deoxygenase in this step, and of course the P450s that could be involved in the epoxidation or hydroxylation in this case. We've also found pretty much all the mevalonate pathway genes in mountain pine beetle, and because our libraries are full-length enriched, we've actually, almost all of them except for the HMGR and potentially the GPPS are full length. So they're ready to go and express if need be. I'd like to now briefly talk about olfaction and some of the genes that we're finding responsible for olfaction. Many of the talks we've seen this conference have been dealing with olfaction, and I just want to show this little schematic here and showing that pheromones or odorants are coming into the antenna and being carried to the receptor through pheromone or odorant binding proteins. When they get to the receptor or prior to it, they can be degraded by pheromone degrading enzymes or odorant degrading enzymes. And there are some components like these sensory neural membrane proteins we're just starting to understand the mechanism of. So in our antenna-specific library, we're finding many of these particular enzymes. So based on build 3, we have approximately 40 tentatively unique genes involved in odorant or pheromone binding proteins or chemosensory proteins, as well as about 15 odorant or pheromone receptors, and potentially 2 sensory neuron membrane proteins. We also are finding quite a number of potential odorant degrading enzymes, such as a cytochrome P450, GST, and other enzymes. And in fact, amongst all our ESTs, within the top 20 of the most abundant transcript is actually a cytochrome P450 found in the antenna. It represents, we have about just under 300 ESTs for this one particular P450, and it is found only in the antenna. So we're actually quite interested in that as a potential P450 involved in odorant or pheromone degradation, and we're currently expressing that in insect cells. So you can see that we have a lot of stuff to work on both the olfaction and pheromone biosynthesis, as well as detoxification and cold tolerance. So we're continuing on and completing the EST sequencing goals. We want to really finish our EST project before we get too deeply into transcript analysis, because we want to have as much knowledge on which to base microarrays and such before we delve too deep into that. We're also currently looking at the EST data to try and find genes that, based on similarity or the expression patterns in the different libraries, are candidates to follow up on. And as you saw from Klaus's talk, transcript analysis is one thing, but that may not necessarily all be the whole story. You know, as we get closer to the actual metabolites, there could be different things going on, for instance, post-translational modifications and things like that. So we're also looking at, or beginning to look at, proteomic analysis and metabolites to try and piece together transcript levels, protein levels, and metabolite levels to help us identify specific genes to follow up on through functional characterization. So finally, I'd like to thank some of the people specifically in my lab that are involved in the cDNA library construction. And for those people who are interested, we do have a website, thetriaproject.ca, which is going to be developed as we go through in this project. So thank you very much. So the question from Gary was if the GGPPS that we're finding is similar to the GPPS in Ipsipinae, and the answer is no. There's no similarity at all. So the closest is actually the Drosophila GGPPS.
GG.
Yeah.
Chris?
You sort of touched on the cold tolerance genes a little bit, and that's important to us in Alberta. What's sort of the sampling protocol for that? Because it's tied to the weather, right? If it's not cold enough, they won't express, they shouldn't express the genes.
Yeah, so since that's sort of my lab, where we have data loggers on trees, and about once a week or so, we're going out and collecting larvae and flash freezing them in the field and bringing them back on dry ice. And the data loggers are continually recording temperature as well. So the idea then is to look at gene expression and look at the temperature as it drops as well.
So right over the winter then?
Well, I mean, into the winter, in the middle of the winter when it's minus 30, we're not expecting much to be going on. So it's sort of as we get into the late fall and early winter, and then we'll pick it up again in the spring too. But as for, when it's minus 20, minus 30, not much ought to be happening. We expect that we'll start doing some proteomics work where we can look for antifreeze proteins that will have accumulated also in the winter. And in that case, we would do samples in the very early fall or late summer compared to samples in the middle of the winter when we'd have accumulated antifreeze proteins, and then compare it again to very late instar larvae or pupae or something like that. So that would be that would be how we go after antifreeze proteins. So because there's different mechanisms for cold tolerance, we have to look at it in different ways. Basically, we don't know if they have antifreeze proteins.
Yeah.
All that we know for sure is that there's potentially glycerol in there from Bart Benz's paper a while ago.
Yeah, I was just worried if it gets cold fast,
yeah.
Might not see.
Yeah, this year's been pretty good. I like the temperatures this year. We've had a nice transition into the winter, so I'm hoping that actually that's. I mean, we really don't have a clue. There could be some insects go by light as well, and there's some possibility of some light filtering through the bark as well. So we're hoping it's temperature induced, but we don't know that.
Yeah, so that's why like he's collecting over a period of time, so that we can both for our CDNA libraries as well as for specific analysis. Have it over the time frame that we expect cold tolerance to kick in. Pamela.
Good. The P450 you said that you found in Nantana that was really highly represented. Have you looked at any regulation to upregulate it by exposing it to all the different pheromones, or is it some specific? Or?
Yeah, so for the library construction, we didn't expose them to anything. We haven't done any transcript analysis of those yet, no. What's interesting about bark beetles is, compared to like moss and things like that, is that it seems like both the males and females have very similar response by GCAAD to both the pheromones and host volatiles. So we may not expect to see a difference, for instance, between male and female, like we often see in moss that we saw earlier this week. Yeah. But whether it develops as the life cycle of the insect changes, yeah, we need to establish that.
York?
Charles was suggesting that you might be suggesting that
it's a hypothesis that I have. I don't have data to support that at this time, but there are some examples. Well, that's my hypothesis.
Chinese group recently fed labeled C13 acetate and melanolactone to a dendrochmus species and were not able to show any incorporation into verbena.
Yeah.
The negative doesn't prove it, but I'm betting it's not data.
Yeah. Well, actually, my pet hypothesis is not more the biosynthesis of alpha-pinene de novo, but rather the biosynthesis of the verbenols de novo. May not necessarily directly involve alpha-pinene.
I've
Did I'm right? Okay.
We'll have to move on,
yeah.
I think, but thank you very much.